found it intriguing. I thought it was so
Capital Investment Committee will come to order on Valentine's Day. Happy Valentine's Day, everyone. You are my Valentines. Close to my heart. Committee members proved themselves yesterday as wonderful tourists on a guided tour, unofficial, and we want to thank Joel Carlson for arranging to set up a meeting at Alliance Field for us. And it was an experience beyond what our expectations were. And I want to thank Mr. McGuire for being an excellent host, and Mr. Carlson for keeping us on time, and we were back by 8:05. So just a little over. But committee members, you outdid yourselves, and I'm ready to commit myself to leading us through the state of Minnesota and once seeing wonderful projects in every region of the state. So we have interim to look forward to. And I'd also like to thank Representative Pearson for his kind comments and enthusiastic comments about our experience yesterday. Going on to today, we have a couple of very interesting projects to hear about, and local importance as well as state of Minnesota importance. And so we will begin with the Hennepin County Regional Medical Examiner's Facility, which sounds so interesting. We see it, things like this on television all the time in the middle of big murder cases and stuff, but I have a feeling that that's a little stretch on the aspects that they do day to day. So, Ms. Lola, welcome to the committee, and please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Melissa Wallach, and I am the Department Administrator for the Medical Examiner's Office, serving Hennepin, Dakota, and Scott Counties. And I work directly with Dr. Andrew Baker, who is the Chief Medical Examiner. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Over the past 3 years, I've had the honor to speak with many of you about the new Regional Medical Examiner Facility Project and details about our mission. And I want to thank you for the two appropriations totaling $17.75 million towards our facility project. You should have two handouts in front of you. One is a handout dated October 2017 that's just a summary of the overall project. And then I also have an additional supplement that talks about an update of the project and the process that we've went through. Before I get started, I want to give a special thanks to all representatives and senators that toured our facility, learned about the work that we do, and developed a shared and bipartisan understanding and gave support to our new facility project. A special thanks to Representative Albright, Mungloom, Dean, Hertaus, and Carlson for authoring our bill last year, Representative Erdahl for inclusion of the project in the last two bonding bills, and then in addition to Senator Pratt and others, and Linda Berglund, who has a long history in the Senate before coming to Hennepin County and prioritizing lobbying for our new facility as her final project before she retired. I see many familiar faces in the room, people that have been on the tour, but nonetheless, I'm going to give you a brief history of the project before I update you on our progress. In your handout with a summary of information, it just goes over just about everything I'm going to talk about, but I'll add some additional information. If you have any questions at the end, you can ask. In addition, we are currently located in a 50-year-old renovated food service building across the street from Hennepin County Medical Center, which is now called Hennepin Healthcare, and the U.S. Bank Stadium. For those of you that have toured the facility, our space challenges that we have are evident, including a body cooler that functions at maximum capacity and an autopsy suite with far less tables than what our work requires on a daily basis. Our three-county service area serves approximately 1.7 million Minnesotans, or a third of the state's population. We have a formal teaching mission that includes medical students, pathology residents, and a forensic fellowship program, which trains future medical examiners. We operate one of the only 35 accredited fellowship programs in the country and have done so for over 30 years and have trained hundreds of medical professionals that have gone to work across the state. The chief medical examiner of Hennepin, Anoka, and Ramsey offices are all alumni of our training program. Our medical examiner's office provides training, support, and infrastructure for local, state, and regional mass fatality preparedness. Our employees hold key positions with state, national, and international organizations, and our subject matter expertise is routinely sought to provide training to county emergency managers and state homeland security offices. So it's clear that our new facility is an investment in the safety and security for all residents in the state of Minnesota. The original budget for the project was $57.8 million, for which we sought $28.9 million in state bonding matched by equal county funds. We received $2.68 million in 2017 and $15.07 million in 2018, which we are incredibly grateful for. But since our total state appropriation was less than requested, the Hennepin County Commissioners sought to reduce the project expense by $10 million to accommodate the difference in funding. Through further analysis and discussion, including reference to Minnesota Statute 16B335 on state bond-financed projects, it was realized that $10 million in a reduction of the project would be a substantial change. And so instead we went through two value engineering sessions to find ways to reduce the project expense. The first one we cut $3 million. The second one, we cut an additional $2 million with taxpayer contribution between the three counties making up the difference. As noted in your handout, we reduced approximately 5,000 square feet from the floor plan while assuring that we would not compromise the core work performed and the longevity of the building. One of the project reductions was an essential piece of radiology equipment used specifically for child abuse cases, which we will diligently pursue outside grant funding for. Our current unit was purchased sometime in the 60s, and our physicist says it can no longer be serviced. This is an example of our choices to preserve the size and scope of the building while making difficult decisions regarding project expenses. The reason we chose to remove what we did was to preserve our core philosophy. If the work can't be performed anywhere else, we will preserve space and programming. We removed hallways, restructured business areas, moved offices, and cut all aesthetics of the building so we could assure that we keep our promise to meet the needs of the community in the future. We also designed the facility to add 50 feet on the end of the business office wing and 50 feet off the autopsy wing in case there's a future need in the future. Two of our biggest concerns are what was value engineered related to energy efficiency and sustainability and escalating building costs as we move into the construction document phase. Under state law, new buildings must consider meeting at least 2% of its energy needs through renewable resources, and we chose to remove extra supports in the business office wing for a future solar farm to meet our expense reductions goal. This could be added later. In speaking with our architects recently, they are concerned that the next estimate will be over budget, and since we have nothing left to cut, we will need to face some of those tough choices that could include reducing or removing a skylight in the autopsy suite, using less expensive flooring material that will have a significantly shorter life expectancy and the ability to clean it effectively, and necessary space for our facilities staff to maintain our building. The work we do is hard. Continued reduction of natural light in the facility will affect our ability to recruit and retain our talent in our field. It could affect our teaching mission and have a ripple effect across the state of Minnesota. To fill positions, we are competing with New Mexico, Nevada, Phoenix, and they also have new facilities and are often challenged to fill positions in the field. So our goal is to keep our promises. We're currently facing escalating construction expense in a situation where we will need to make those very difficult choices, and they will have some level of impact on our future and the ability to give the highest level of service to Minnesotans. My biggest concern is sacrificing taxpayer dollars now at the expense of paying more in the future. We will do everything in our power to assure that our decisions are forward-thinking, but we have reached limits of our creativity. I don't have answers what would happen if additional bonding dollars were received for our project, but I can assure you that we would use it in any way, in a way that would save taxpayer dollars in the future, in addition to lessening taxpayer dollars for our citizens. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
When you talk about taxpayer dollars, mm-hmm. are you talking about taxpayers of Hennepin, Scott, and Dakota mm-hmm. property taxes?
Yes. Since our department is, Madam Chair, our department is completely taxpayer-funded. We have a small amount of revenue, but it's mainly taxpayer-funded.
But the capital money is also taxpayers' money.
That's correct, and that's why we took the time to make sure that we value-engineered appropriately, looked at the building, and we're determined to come in under budget.
And are there any additional monies besides property taxes that fund your operating expenses?
Madam Chair, at this point, we get a small amount of money for room rental through our donor agencies for procurement, which is tissue donation. We also have a current agreement with Hennepin County Medical Center. We function as their morgue and their autopsy, which will be changing when we move to the new facility. And that's approximately $121,000. And otherwise, we have a very small amount that we bill for fees for reports.
Thank you. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Ms. Lalek. We're going to be running into this with lots of projects. Mm-hmm. The construction market is very good right now for contractors. Costs are going up, and you use a term that just makes me cringe every time I hear it, value engineering.
I know.
There's virtually, it's presented as a positive act, and it's actually a negative act. You reduce the scope. You often reduce the quality. When you talk about cutting some issues around energy use, that's going to be long-term impact on your operating budget. We're going to be in a real crisis as we begin to look at projects through this year. Right now, it sounds like Hennepin County stepped up a little bit to provide more funding. But my fear is, as with many, not many, but some of the projects that we do, we go through a process just to try to make the money work. And in the end, we get a facility that really doesn't meet our needs. When I read that you're talking about taking out skylights, you're talking about, addressing issues of windows and all those other types of things, this is a place that I would say I would have a lot of trouble working there. So the aesthetics of it are probably really critical to the ongoing mental health of everybody that works there. Don't get me wrong, I believe an usual person would work at a facility like this, but at the same time, this is one of those projects that I think is critical to the region, in some ways to the state, because occasionally there are some cases. But I think this is something that as we move forward, that, we tried really, really hard to get them the money last year, and we fell short because we didn't have enough money because we had an artificial limit that was put in place. And then we tried to do some, a shell game with some money, and we're trying to fix that now. I would hope that as we move forward that we really consider providing more funding to this project and try to make it as whole as we can, because it will have a substantially long life in its use and its need. And if we can find a little extra money to make sure that the facility meets what we originally set out for to meet in our funding, I think that would be better for everybody in the end. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are all the funds that were allocated last year and the year before promised out now?
Madam Chair, you mean promised?
Well,
to?
That they're in use or they have been spent.
Madam Chair, at this point, in finishing up design development, we're still in the planning phase. We do have an expense schedule that was created, and that involves all three counties, Hennepin, Dakota, and Scott. So all of the funds, no, and I know there's some state bonding rules with how the funding is used. So we're in the process of evaluating exactly what that looks like.
So correct me if I'm wrong. You're still in the design planning phase.
Yes, that is correct.
We haven't started building yet.
That is correct.
You have the place, so you have the land.
We have the land. And our, Madam Chair, the property is out in Minnetonka. It's a Hennepin County-owned piece of property that also houses the Hennepin County Homeschool. So it was a gift from Hennepin County. Okay. And we've been working with the City of Minnetonka to look at where the facility should be located. So we have the land. We have the place where it's going to be built. We've made it through our design development phase, so the next step is construction documents.
Thank you. Representative Erdoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And how many morgues are there in the state?
We have a total of 4. There's 4 in the state of Minnesota. There's 1 up in Duluth. There is Ramsey County. There is Hennepin, Dakota, and Scott County. And then there's a small one-table facility down in Rochester.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. And how many counties use your facility?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, at this point we have our primary 3-county area, but by nature of having hospitals in our area that accept level 1 traumas, we end up getting different cases from all over the state of Minnesota. And we also have a certain number of referral counties. So these are smaller counties that have coroners that don't do their own autopsies, and they send their work to us, and we also perform those duties.
Okay, Madam Chair.
And Ms. Lalak, you build them back.
That is correct.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. Well, just want to say that, you know, I think that this is a valuable project, a meritorious project. We, Representative Dean is correct that had we had more money available to us, we likely would have put more into this last year. I don't know if a tour is scheduled for the summer or not.
You're welcome to come.
I've been there. I've been there, and I'm not coming back. But it is a valuable thing for, I think, all members to see once. But thank you.
Representative Sock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question isn't directed at anything other than my ignorance. So do you do any federal work at all, federal cases, that sort of thing? Do they flow through your facility?
Representative Sock, we don't have cases directly coming through our facility, but we're used as a resource often. In fact, there was a case recently, and we ended up having the FBI come out and actually ask for our expertise in a specific area. So we had a group of medical examiners consult on the case. And we do have a number of those just because of the nature of the work that we do and the expertise in our office. And Dr. Baker is nationally, well, he actually is known across the world as an expert in his field. So our group is consulted often for high-level cases.
Representative Salk.
I also just want to comment relative to Representative Dean's issues is that I'm very disappointed oftentimes in my experience here so far where we really do walk away from, I think, critical things for our society looking long term, and we put the guise is we don't have enough money or that sort of thing. That's because we are making that decision, and it's because in the end, whether it was Representative Erdahl personally or all of us collectively in the committee, we sometimes just chose something else also. And not that that's a negative thing. We do have to make those choices, and there are things, needs that are very, also very critical in their space. But I think that there are some things that we as a state are stepping up and coming up very short in terms of our responsibility to provide the funds that it takes to have these kinds of facilities. This is one of those few places where I don't think we're going to have a lot of state investigation facilities in this field. We aren't going to populate them around. That somebody else is going to do them. We have one table down at Rochester, and not that we need more than that. Maybe we do. I'm suspecting that we really do. But the fact is that these are very expensive facilities, and we as a state need to find a way to step up to this kind of project. So just leave that as an editorial.
Appreciate that. Any other questions? Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for the good testimony. I just want to say thank you for the tour I had. I can't remember if it was last year or the year before. Time flies. But I found it very interesting. I see the need is very great. Mm-hmm. And just an added comment. So I'm a former first grade teacher, and we always, part of our curriculum was teaching needs versus wants. And I do believe this is a need. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Second item on the agenda today is the Fort Snelling's Visitor Center, Minnesota Historical Society. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, there are some Valentine's Day goodies here.
Not a first. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd like to start out there. It's an informational hearing, but there is an amendment that has been placed on this bill yesterday, and that is on the bill. The appropriation is now $12 million and not $15 million. So the state saved $3 million yesterday. The Fort Snelling site, of course, one of our iconic historic sites in Minnesota, very important to the state for many reasons, and needs to undergo a renovation, a restoration, if you will, of its visitor center, actually a demolition and start over of its visitor center, using the barracks and the Historical Society officials here will explain this in more detail, so I think I'll just let them explain what the project is and why it's so important.
Thank you. Director Whitworth, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and guests. My name is Kent Whitworth. It's my privilege to serve as the director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. With me representing MNHS is my colleague David Kelleher, our Director of Public Policy. Also with us are a couple of members of our leadership team, Melanie Adams, our Deputy Director for Learning Initiatives, and Jennifer Jones, who is our Deputy Director for Preservation and Outreach. Doug Marty, our Deputy Director of Administration, is actually out at Historic Fort Snelling this morning, but I appreciate them being with me. I also want to express my thanks publicly to Representative Erdahl for bringing this bill forward. Today, we are here to provide a brief overview of the historic site, and I'll ask David to advance that slide. Thank you. we will talk a little bit about the site itself, where we plan to go from here in terms of this project. Just a quick reminder, and I'm hoping that most of you have had the opportunity, either on a field trip or when family was in, to visit Historic Fort Snelling. If you have not, we'd be honored to give you a tour once the weather warms up a little bit. But you can see that the Historic Fort Snelling is located in a major metropolitan area, a crossroads of modern transportation routes, as well as at the confluence of the Mississippi and Minnesota rivers. As Representative Erdahl said, this place is plays a prominent role in our history and has so for centuries. This is Minnesota's first national historic landmark. That signals national significance, but it also signals a series of formal reviews during the project implementation process, and we're happy to talk about that later in more detail. But I would argue that this is not only of state and national significance, but that this historic site is of international significance as well, partially because of the depth and breadth of the stories now being told at Historic Fort Snelling. We are have been involved in this project for a number of years. As many of you know, we have finished a master plan, and the design development phase is about finished. This image gives you a sense of that property. To the right is the diamond, the historic fort that was finished in 1820. And then to the left there, you see three historic buildings, two of which will be, we hope, the centerpiece of this project. One in particular will be the centerpiece of this project. David, if you would move forward. Representative Erdahl mentioned a current visitor center. If you've been out there before, you know that visitor center is underground. It opened around 1980, and in those days, there was some wisdom that underground facilities were a good idea. These images maybe reinforce the notion that, in retrospect, that may not have been the best approach. Frankly, the building has had challenges. Has leaked from day one, and you see images that reinforce those challenges. But I want you to understand that we have conducted engineering studies about the long-term viability of the visitor center, and we've concluded that it's not a wise investment to continue to put dollars into this facility. So, as we said, we're going to turn our attention to a couple of historic buildings. And this, I think, this overview image really captures the transformation of that space at Historic Fort Snelling. You see how we will be able to bring the landscape to life, but you also see circled in the foreground a single-story ordnance building. We refer to that as Building 22. And then behind it are a couple of cavalry barracks. The first one is Building 18, and that's a multi-story facility that will, frankly, do a lot of the heavy lifting for the public functions of this site going forward. The bulk of the construction work will focus around Building 18 here. And if we go to the next slide, you'll see a couple of bubble diagrams that reinforce the functions of that space. The lower level with support facilities, the main level with lobby and basic visitor experiences, a 4,000 square foot exhibition gallery, a museum shop, and then on the upper floors is a more dedicated space for educational programming aimed particularly at school groups, and also some modest spaces for rental facilities. And the lower portion of that image is Building 22, the ordnance facility. That's a single-story building that would be used as an orientation not only for the historic fort, but also for the entire historic Fort Snelling footprint, Upper Post and State Park and all of that. So I'm going to ask David if he would speak to the budget of where it stands.
Director Kelleher.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm David Kelleher, Minnesota Historical Society. This slide gives you a recap of the funding for this project over the years, starting in the year 2015. 2015 when we received an appropriation for pre-design, followed by a 2017 appropriation for design, and then followed by an appropriation for construction in 2018. And as we've discussed, that appropriation was only a portion of what we had requested. So what we did since the end of the last legislative session in 2018 was consulted with our architectural team, sharpened our pencils, we won't use that term that Representative Dean doesn't like, and figured out that what we can do with the funding that's available, not knowing whether additional funding for the full vision of this project would be available in a future bonding year, whether it's this year or beyond. So at the end of last year, we received information, cost information and design information from the architects on what the remaining revised vision would be. And as Kent said, that first segment really does focus on Building 18, the Cavalry Barracks building, where we would have visitor services. But an important part of this project as well is the interpretive landscape. This site is adjacent to the Mississippi River, and you can see the river gorge and the two downtowns off in the distance. And visitors can come to this site and spend the day and not really know that they're next to the Mississippi River. We don't want that to continue because this is the Mississippi River is really one of the reasons that this site is a significant place, the confluence of the two rivers, the Dakota history, Native American history over centuries. The other thing to mention is that in addition to the bonding appropriation last year, we've been really hard at work raising non-state private funds for this project. Minnesotans really, really care about this place, and the fundraising has gone very well. And in hand and pledged, non-state totals $15 million. Some of the pledged money is in the form of planned gifts, so they don't come until later, but that fundraising will help us achieve the vision. This request, as Representative Erdahl said, to do some further work is $12 million to do Building 22 and some enhancements to the interpretive landscape, visitor wayfinding, and some other features. So the total project cost is $46.5 million with those elements all added up.
Thank you, David. I just want to reinforce that the historic Fort Snelling has been a very compelling project to our donors, and I think it's very significant that $15 million have been committed from the private sectors, individuals, foundations, corporations to support this project. So we're not relying strictly on public funding. It's we're very aggressively pursuing private support as well. So if we move to the next image, as we said, Building 18 is the education center, the visitor center as well, but it's the entire property that will be revitalized. And if we go to the next image, this is an important point for us to make. The interpretive program is already expanding, and we are piloting a number of new interpretive programs and experiences, but they're anchored by our military history story and the veteran story. We've been telling those stories for generations. We will continue to tell those stories. But there's additional emphasis that will be told about the stories of freedom. Many of us know the story of Dred and Harriet Scott, and that story unfolded right there at Fort Snelling. This past season, we were able to do much more with the World War II story, the Japanese-American language school, which had a profound impact on shortening World War II. And certainly the Native American history that is found throughout the historic Fort Snelling footprint is very significant, and the landscape will be key to bringing that Dakota homeland story to life. So we are very excited about what's already happening from the new interpretive programming, and the construction will simply enhance that. So I then will ask David if he would show a very short video. It lasts just over a minute, but I think it maybe brings some additional imagery to our presentation.
Let's see.
mighty rivers, many cultures, thousands of years of rich history. In 2020, historic Fort Snelling will be 200 years old, and it shows. The fort's buildings, grounds, and programs are in urgent need of revitalization. Our plan includes a new visitor center and renovated cavalry barracks, outdoor spaces that promote learning, reflection, and connection to the natural beauty of this extraordinary place. New exhibits and programs that showcase the many unique stories that unfolded here on sacred Dakota homeland. It's where soldiers trained to defend our country and where an enslaved family began its quest for freedom. Historic Fort Snelling, Minnesota's first national historic landmark.
Mr. Kelleher, thank you.
Glad it worked. Madam Chair, members of the committee, as Kent mentioned a couple of minutes ago, we want to reemphasize that because this historic place is a national historic landmark, it has and will receive extensive historic preservation reviews. This is part of a federal Section 106 under the National Historic Preservation Act, Section 106 review that is headed by the National Park Service. They're the lead agency with reviews by the State Historic Preservation Office. Additionally, consulting parties such as Native American tribes, community organizations, and others have signed on to a programmatic agreement, which is the roadmap for how the reviews are to be done. And we have been hard at work with the National Park Service and the State Historic Preservation Office, involved in a lot of detail on this site, on historic landscapes and archaeology, on how that work will be done. The committee yesterday that heard this bill, State Government Finance, and this committee has received some communications about burial sites and graves, and we want to assure you that we are paying close attention to that. We distributed a letter that has documented the work that we are doing and will do in the future to ensure that if there are burials on this site, that they will be cared for in the most professional, respectful way, as we always do. We have done surveys. We have done ground-penetrating radar. We have done some site testing to determine if there are cemeteries on the locations that we plan to do some work on this site, and we'll follow all the rules, and we have. So the consultation process in the Section 106 review, working through the National Park Service, allows individuals to comment and consult with the National Park Service on that. So
thank you. And there is that paper in your packet.
And Madam Chair, we distributed a letter that should be that looks like this. That's a two-page memo from the Minnesota Historical Society outlining our actions in this area.
All right. Mr. Whitworth, let's go back. I'm a little confused about the request of your projected request of this year.
Mm-hmm.
And the leaky visitor center that you have two pictures of in the folder.
Uh-huh.
And then you just went on to the presentation of the two historical buildings that you want to preserve. And that's part of your ask. So what are we doing about the current visitor center?
The visitor center will be deconstructed, will be removed, and covered over.
and that's where the that'll be part of the sort of the landscape revitalization. In fact, I think the legislation from last year specifically referred to the removal of the current visitor center as part of the scope of the project. In the slide that's up, if you see that green space behind Building 22, that's the location of the current visitor center. And that's where the underground visitor center will be removed and new landscaping planted.
All right. So the visitor center is disappearing, and Building 22 is going to have functions built into it that the visitor center is now doing.
Actually, Building 18, the multi-story first barrack building, will be the primary education and visitor center for the historic Fort Snelling experience. Oh. If additional funding comes, then Building 22, the single-story building, would be renovated for an orientation site for the entire historic Fort Snelling complex. If we do not secure additional funds, Building 22 will not be open to the public.
Oh, all right. So Building 18 is what's going
yes.
to take over the duties
yes.
of the visitor center.
Correct.
What was the original price of the underground building?
I do not know
visitor center. I don't remember it, although I was on the tour that convinced us that there was a great need for it.
We
and it's served all these years.
Madam Chair, I don't know how much that cost originally in the late 70s, early 80s, but we're
going to explore that, aren't we, Mr. Lee? We're going to explore that in the future. Thank you.
Sure.
All right. Representing Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for the presentation. And I'm not sure who the person to ask this question to, so I'll ask it to all of you. So as we look at the, the design in moving forward with the new visitor center, I keep looking at this other building that no one ever talks about.
Right.
And that's Building 17.
Yes.
And so what is sort of the future plans for Building 17? What sort of role does that play in, the whole Fort Snelling complex?
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, Building 17 is stable. There's been ongoing core maintenance to that facility, but at this time there are no plans for that to become a public space. If additional funds are secured, we'll do a little bit more structural and cosmetic work to 17 so that Building 18 and 17 look more compatible. But at this stage of the game, we do not plan to develop that space publicly. Frankly, the cost of that was prohibitive several years ago when that was studied.
Madam Chair,
Representative Dean.
I would just encourage you to think what might this be 50 years from now. And, maybe there's a role for the building, maybe there's not a role for the building. But I think, thinking about, two, 3 years out, I think is really, not a realistic point of view. But, I'm sure that, we're going to have a big celebration here coming up. Another 50 years, we'll have another big celebration coming up. And maybe that's something people can start sort of planting seeds or thinking about what might happen there.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, certainly if we look at a 50-year window, we would absolutely see educational and interpretive opportunities for that space, maybe even in the next 15 to 20 years. But within the next 5 to 10, we do not see public use of that space. It's more about making sure it's stable and that we're not letting small problems escalate into larger challenges.
Thank you, Madam.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Whitworth, my question is on the line of Chair Murphy with regards to the current visitor center. I see on here that there's a picture with a tarp. Is that room or that space still open to the public, and is there a public safety concerns for when visitors enter that space if it is still open?
Mr. Whitworth.
Madam Chair, I'm going to yield to
Kelleher.
David.
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, the picture on the right with the tan-colored tarp is archaeology lab area, so it's not generally open to the public, but it's not a great workspace for the people who work there, needless to say. And that tarp collects water from the water ceiling and then drains into a drain that goes to a sump pump that's running 24 hours a day. So it's not a great workspace. It's not something we should have people work in.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. I was just going to add to what Mr. Kelleher said. I mean, you have, in the 1970s, this was a common form of architecture to build into the ground. And this was built into the ground at the confluence of two rivers. Probably not the best idea. And as a result, you have, as Mr. Whitworth said, almost from the beginning, you have leakage into the building. A sump pump, as David just says, running continuously, but I believe you have one or two other sump pumps as well that run frequently. So they're constantly draining water out of this, and it's just not a good site to welcome people to Fort Snelling.
Madam Chair. Representative Lee.
So, Mr. Kelleher, thank you, Madam Chair. So is there public safety concerns for the workers who are working in that space right now, then?
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, our plan with the current funding that was appropriated last year is to move the archaeology staff who work there now to a different location beginning this spring, late winter and spring. So they will be moved out of there in that damp environment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. If I could just add, I mean, certainly I haven't heard anything, but there must be mold concerns as well that would affect anyone working there.
Thank you. Representative Tarkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for being here today, Dr. Wentworth and others. The issue of the cemetery is something I was not aware of before today. I'm just curious, how well documented was the work that was done, excavation that was done during the building of the existing visitor center in relation to this issue?
Madam Chair.
Director Whitworth.
Representative Turkelson, I would direct your attention to the memo that was provided. And then I don't know if I might ask my colleague Jennifer Jones, who oversees this area of our work, the archaeological work, she might be able to speak a little bit more about the documentation from the time of the construction of the current visitor center, and then talk a little bit more about moving forward.
So, Jennifer Jones. I appreciate that.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, for the record, my name is Jennifer Jones. I'm the Director of Preservation and Outreach at the Minnesota Historical Society. Prior to the construction of the 1980 Visitor Center, we did a full archaeological survey. That was carried out by the Director of Archaeology at the time, Bob Klaus. It was a shovel testing survey, so the nature of that is that across a large area of property, you shovel test, run what you find through a screen to determine if there's any evidence of anything in there. We had documentary evidence that the cemetery was in that area, but that it had been moved and that 223 graves had been relocated. We have known, as we wrote in the memo, from the time that the property was transferred to the Minnesota Historical Society in the 1960s, that the possibility that there could be additional graves are there. All archaeologists who've ever worked in cemetery areas know that graves are often unmarked and forgotten. So we've always been extremely careful about that. That was the purpose of the survey. Archaeologists always fully document these things so that we have full documentation of that in our records, and there was no evidence of any kind of burial or faunal remains found.
Representative Tarkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in the adjacent property, was any of that surveyed? I'm not real familiar with the site in perspective of the cemetery, but are there any other portions of this area that may contain graves that we haven't explored?
Ms. Jones. I think it's important to remember, Madam Chair and Representative, that the nature of this site is that it has been intensively occupied by Europeans since the 19th century and by Native Americans for more than 10,000 years. And so the possibility that we might find human remains is always there. That's also true, as you all know, of any road project we might do in Minnesota, of any building that you might do. And that's the purpose of the Cemeteries Act, Statute 307.08, is to make sure that whenever the ground is disturbed in any context, whether at Fort Snelling or someplace else, that we take due care in making sure that if human remains are found, there's a process for dealing with them.
Representative Parker. Well,
thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your sensitivity to this issue. I think it's an important one. Being a cemetery board member myself for the past 30-some-odd years, I appreciate the history that's involved in all cemeteries, really, across the state, and the effort to preserve this information is not a simple one. We think with all this digitizing of everything that we've made it easier, I think in some ways we've made it more difficult. Current practice with cremains kind of alarm. This is, I'm giving a little oration here, sorry, Madam Chair, but you know, we're pretty careless about what we do with human remains these days. It has nothing to do with this project, I realize, but I think it's something we should all consider. If this is so important that we should all document where our loved ones are being put to rest
or blowing in the wind. Anything else? Okay. Before you leave, we have a request to speak. Stephanie Chappelle.
Madam Chair, thanks for the time before the committee.
I don't know if you're dismissed yet.
Oh. We're going to just make space for the best.
Ms. Chappelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representatives. My name is Stephanie Chappell of Glencoe, Minnesota. Full of transparency regarding the Section 106 that they did mention, a group was formed and added to the Section 106 and approved in August of 2018. I am the consulting representative, or excuse me, the authorized representative for that group. That group has nothing to do with today. It's a federal approval program. I am here on behalf of myself, families of veterans, and I come from a military families. So a packet was forwarded to you yesterday, I understand, and I emailed it to you last night also. From research I've done,
It is in our folders.
Thank you. And that might have been forwarded from the State Government Finance Committee.
No, I believe it came from you.
Oh, a state representative also forwarded it to you. And I received confirmation. She let me know that she did forward it to the next committee for consideration. Do you have questions about this document?
No, I thought my understanding was that you have a statement to make about Fort Snelling and about the plan, and this is your chance to make the statements, and then there may be questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Fort Snelling deserves to be protected. In the past, it has not. All the best has been done to preserve Fort Snelling and the area. This and last year's proposed plan does not include the historic diamond at all. It affects everything else, but not the historic fort. So if you keep that in mind as you consider this $12 million. I was not aware of any changes previously until this morning, but the document that I put together for you is based on some research that I as a person put together, and I was floored when I realized that a cemetery existed there. I did not know that. If you look at their plans on page 3, the cemetery can be adjacent to it. And from looking at this, where they have H, a planned amphitheater, right between B, 22 and 18, that's an area that has not been checked for the cemetery. It's also an area that, from a 1959 aerial, may well have remains in it. From looking at the area, the cemetery, and if you look at the front page, it shows buildings 18 and the 22 also. 22 is also marked on the very front page of the email that I sent to you. When you look at that, you'll see that there's a pavement area right there. That was in existence. Right next to it, if you have the chance to view it, there is a driveway right next to building 18. And that was also the same driveway that went through in the 1959 picture. Then if you tour it this right now or drive over there, there is a grass area with some larger pine trees right next to a small parking area that may have been added. That could hold remains. Building 22 could not be determined because of its fragile nature. So there hasn't been much done there. In the past, the Historical Society has mentioned themselves in a report that they did themselves by their own employees in 2007 that there could be remains there. In 2018, last fall, an outside company was hired and they found what appeared to be cemetery post and rubble in the area. Their area that they were hired to do did not include the area between 18 and others. There's just too much there to start a construction period now. Too much. The bicentennial is not 2020. I can send you documentation if you'd like to show that in Colonel Snelling's own hand. And if you have any other questions regarding this, please contact me. I believe there are others that know. Today I wanted to send you something and say, choose one of these names and take them as your Valentine. Those are the ones that were lucky. Those are one of the 223 that did get excavated by McMarty and Sons in 1905. There are more. They weren't lucky. In 1911, 32 more bodies were found. You weren't told about that. And you weren't told about caving in and filling in the current visitor center. There's a pressure component there. And if the pressure isn't addressed, I don't know what would happen to the bluff. There's a pressure piece that a Cornack did a year ago for finance and commerce. And he said, well, we plan to just put it in on each other, and when we get it all out, we'll drill some holes in the cement that we leave and bring it up to grade. That's not what you do with a bluff that delicate. It is our landscape. And in the cemetery that was there, it wasn't just military or Europeans that were there. There's at least one instant where an Ojibwe was there. It wasn't just Dakota that were there. They were pushed out. They pushed out other tribes, federally recognized and non-federally recognized. And one of the pictures that was shown was a monument that already exists in Fort Snelling State Park. It was just used Saturday to commemorate a memorial and memorialize with a traditional bonfire by a non-federally recognized tribe. It was touching. And that's what I want to get through. Bidote is no longer mentioned in the presentation because Bidote is not on the bluff. Bidote is in the historic park, and it's already celebrated there. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Ergal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wondering if the Historical Society wanted any response to that, or...
Mr. Kelleher? Mr. Whitworth? Thank you, Mrs. Chappelle.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as I said earlier, the federal review does have everything to do with this whole project that you're hearing about today, and there's a very specific process to take into account what is known and what is not known on that site. And surveys are done, past records are searched, all different kinds of information is researched to ensure that any potential burials are treated in a respectful way. We are covering the entire site where any possible construction would take place, and the process, and Ms. Chappelle mentioned that she is a consulting party, her organization Voices is a consulting party to that programmatic agreement. Materials about archaeological surveys and investigations have been sent out to the consulting parties and the signatories to that programmatic agreement, and we checked with the National Park Service on when those things were sent out. Several were sent out last year with a 30-day comment period, and we're following the process that's in place to check on these resources.
Thank you very much. Representative Ergal.
Thank you, and just to add, the diamond that was referenced, work was done there before. The diamond was basically restored. Maybe there is more work that at some time needs to be done, but at the present time, the focus is on the visitor center and leading to building 18 and 22. So, thank you for the time.
Could get Representative more? Tarkelson.
I'm sorry to extend this a little bit longer, but the process of demolition of the existing visitor center, I think you should probably address that was brought up also.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, thanks for reminding us of that. We have had an architectural firm with engineers and construction company advise us on the best way to do that, whether it's to remove the entire structure or to dig underground several feet and then fill in to stabilize that and then figure out a way to make sure that the water that's caused us problems over these years has a way to escape. So engineers who are obviously a lot smarter than me are working on that to figure out the best way to do that.
I'm resisting the urge to ask if it's the same architectural firm as built it.
Madam Chair, it's
or designed it.
It's definitely not.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Is that it?
That's it.
Well, thank you very much. I just want to apologize quickly. My phone did ring, and that was because Matt Dean still knows I'm here. He's a history of
what a good friend.
He always made phone calls whenever I walked into a room.
What a good friend. The next item on the agenda is the MHFA Housing Infrastructure Bonds by the Public Housing Rehabilitation Service. Welcome to the committee, and please explain who you are, what you do, because parts of housing are parts of the Capital Investment Committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Ryan Baumtrag. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Policy and Community Development at Minnesota Housing. And we'll bring up the PowerPoint in a second. But before we get into recent selections for authorization that this committee and the legislature has provided the agency to help finance housing across the state, we wanted to spend a little bit of time about what is financed through the capital investments, because there are specific tools that you equip the agency with to help meet the statewide needs.
Good. And I know we made you wait with your little thumb drive. But.
One thing that I believe the PowerPoint is in your packet. Thank you, Jenny, for that.
Oh.
There's a couple overview slides that speak generally about the need for affordable housing in the state and some trends that we're seeing. And given the time constraint and knowing that you are done at 9:30, we'll probably not spend too much time going over that, but just wanted to talk about the critical need overall for housing development and preservation across the state. A recent housing task force identified that a lot of recommendations and goals, two of which are very relevant to today's conversation, which is to develop new affordable housing and also preserve the housing that we currently have. So we'll go into a little bit more throughout the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dan Kitzberger. I'm the Legislative Director for Minnesota Housing. So we thought we'd start up.
And Minnesota Housing is a state agency, correct?
That's correct. Formerly known as the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency.
Right. And when did it begin?
Madam Chair, we began in 1971.
Yeah. Before my time.
Before my time as well. Yes, we are.
Really before my time.
We are an independent, separated legally from the state, which relates to our topic today, which is the state provides us authority to issue bonds and to issue bonds for certain types of housing that is not publicly owned, since most of the housing in the state is not publicly owned.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We just have a couple of slides that provide some context. So what we're here to talk about today is affordable housing, and what we want you to walk away with is an understanding that in the same way that roads or bridges or university campuses or historical site visitor centers are critical infrastructure, that a stock of decent, safe, affordable housing that's available statewide is critical as well. So what does the need for affordable housing look like across the state? So what this graph depicts is over the past couple of decades, the growing gap between what renter households earn and what it costs to rent. So you can see in the early 2000s that gap began to grow, and then it exacerbated post-recession and then persisted really within the last decade. So what we saw is overall a 12% increase in rents and a 4% decrease in rents for lower household incomes. So that's those earning $50,000 or less per year. And this is what that need looks like throughout the state. So we've got about 250,000 low-income renter households that are considered cost burdens, so those who are paying 30% or more of their income for their housing. And you can see that that's most acute within the metro area. So we're also working to end homelessness in the state. So in 2014, we launched the Heading Home Plan. So this is a plan that's being implemented and overseen by the Minnesota Interagency Council on Homelessness. This has a number of tasks that are delegated to state agencies, as well as metrics that they're held accountable to each year that plan is in place. And you have seen since we've been better coordinating our efforts, we have seen a decrease in homelessness, particularly in the area of families, in that time. But it, Still, we know that on any given night, over 7,000 Minnesotans experience homelessness. We will see updated numbers from the Wilder Foundation, or Wilder Research does a survey every 3 years in the fall. They did it this past fall, so we'll have updated numbers later on this spring. We also need to respond to Minnesota's aging population. You can see that in the next 20 years, we are poised for a rapidly aging demographic, particularly in greater Minnesota. These darker blue areas are counties where we'll see more than a third of residents over the age of 65. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Baumtrog, who will talk about the different types of bonds we use and their uses.
Mr. Baumtrog.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. So first wanted to cover housing infrastructure bonds, which were first authorized by the legislature back in 2012, really to underscore the appreciation that housing is a critical asset, but that in the state, most housing is privately owned and not publicly owned, and therefore utilizing general obligation bonds and the restraints on public ownership really didn't allow us to meet the needs across the state for the housing. And so housing infrastructure bonds were created, and effectively what they are is they help the agency and communities fill gaps with development costs. The rents that are collected in these developments don't pay for the costs to either keep up with the rehabilitation or to build new if the new construction use is being used, particularly for homeless populations who typically are not able to pay rent, but yet to build a new building, we need resources in order to help the construction, and the housing infrastructure bonds really help bring that gap resource to help developments work. One thing about the state resources is it's just not the only thing that goes into these developments across the state. These significantly leverage private resources, other federal resources, local county resources. It is a real collaboration between the federal, state, local governments, philanthropic and private communities to help address the housing needs in the community. And as I mentioned briefly earlier, it is the state that provides the debt service, and then Minnesota Housing for housing infrastructure bonds. We run a once-a-year RFP where we select projects, and then Minnesota Housing issues the bonds to help finance those projects when the projects need those resources. So we wait until projects are selected, until they actually need the resources, and then we issue the bonds utilizing the state's resources to pay the debt service on what we issue for those projects. There are several uses of housing infrastructure bonds, two of which were added last year with the bonding bill that I'll go through in a little detail. The first priority and one of the main strategic priorities for the agency is to preserve federally assisted housing. So this is housing that was financed, built, or owned by the federal government in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. It is a critical housing stock. It's in all 87 counties. I'm sure most of you around the table know the project in your community, the rural development project, the public housing project that was built in your community and continues to serve the community. Preserving that asset is important because they work with federal contracts, and often those contracts are up, they expire. And so we work with the owners and property managers to preserve those projects. We provide some additional rehabilitation to those projects. And in turn, then those developments renew their contract with the federal government for typically another 20 years. If we let those contracts expire, those rent subsidies that really help the low-income households leave Minnesota and they do not come back. And so that's why we make preservation a really top priority for the agency. Another key use, given the demand and the number, the unacceptable number of those that are experiencing homelessness, is to build permanent supportive housing for those individuals and families experiencing homelessness. This point hits on a couple slides that Dan touched on earlier about the need for those experiencing homelessness, but also touches on the Fort Snelling project, in that the state is making significant efforts to end homelessness for veterans, And over the past several years, we have financed three projects that are in St. Cloud and two in Minneapolis that are about ending veterans' homelessness and are permanent supportive housing for homeless vets that link housing stability and then access to health care through the VA facility. So permanent supportive housing is a significant use, and is we could not build the buildings across the state, and it is a statewide tool without the resources that we get from the legislature to do that. Another use is for home ownership. We're able to utilize housing infrastructure bonds to purchase the land in community land trusts. And by purchasing and using this resource for the land, it makes home ownership more affordable to more Minnesotans. So that's the use of housing infrastructure bonds that are for home ownership. And then last year in the bonding bill, there was two new uses, given the demand that we're hearing and seeing and feeling across the state for new senior affordable development. This use was added last year in the bonding bill. So we expect this upcoming year to get a lot of requests through our process to build senior housing across the state in the metro as well as in greater Minnesota. And then finally, manufactured home park infrastructure was added last year as well. So Minnesota Housing has several resources to help homeowners that live in manufactured home park communities to rehab their individual homes and to help them get into those or replace those homes, but we did not have a source to do the infrastructure of the park since they're typically privately owned, and so this will be a new resource and tool to help preserve those manufactured home communities across the state. Briefly talk a little bit about leverage and demand for the resources. Since 2012, we've awarded just over $190 million in housing infrastructure bonds, and it's led to the total development of just about $380 million. So it gives you the scale of the importance and critical nature of the resources we get from the state, but it's not the state doing this alone. It is private resources, other federal resources that really help these projects be completely financed. As I mentioned before, preservation is a key priority. When we preserve a property, we're preserving for every $1, $4 in federal assistance that flows to the state, and if we didn't do that, those $4 would not be coming to the state. So that's a critical resource to serve really low-income Minnesotans that we want to maintain. And then with the exception being last year when we had two new eligible uses, we're typically oversubscribed for housing infrastructure bonds, about one in every 3 to 4 projects that we're able to finance. And so the resource really helps us finance more of the requests that we're getting every year to fund projects across the state.
Representative Saul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate jumping in right now to a couple of the slides that you went through, and because of my age, I want to make sure I remember what my question was. So if you turn to page 4 in the slides, it's the one where you got the need of affordable housing and then a graph, a line graph that The question is that the lines, there we go, and I'm interested in the blue line, which is youth, is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Because that mine's black and white, and no. So that's why I think maybe the question came up. So what I was interested in is categorization contributing to what the lines appear to show, or because the blue line sort of shows up mid-time in this set of graphs, it was just hard for me to interpret now, much easier with the colors being apparent as to why the categories were moving each of those directions. I think maybe that actually helped my question. And the other one, sorry to be kind of randomly about this, but the other one has to do where you were talking about HIV-eligible uses, and you mentioned that there are three veterans uses that have come on cycle. You mentioned, I think, St. Cloud and two in the Twin Cities?
Correct. Yep.
Okay. That leads me to then ask, do you have a grasp of, and I suspect it's a challenge, do you have a grasp of the distribution of need across the state? And one of the things I'll bring up is that
there has been some work done in terms of being able to find and deliver services to veterans as they are coming out of combat or coming out of service, those kinds of things, in that they don't present themselves like, oh, knock on the door, hi, I'm really having mental problems figuring out my housing. They just don't do that. And so they're sitting in very inadequate housing, maybe in the woods around Mankato, or very inadequate housing somewhere around Rochester, you know, where there's at least a population center that they sort of can reference from, but they're living disconnected and in very inadequate housing and are post-service veterans. If our only facilities exist here and St. Cloud, well, great for those two facilities, but we've got a lot of people spread around the state that are much more rural, that have no proximity to services, and they're just not inherently going to go seek it out. So I gave you a great big field there to talk about.
Sure. Madam Chair and Representative, the one thing I'll say, this we could spend a lot more time, and maybe we should meet to talk a little bit and include the Department of Veterans Affairs, who has a specific project or specific work geared towards this about identification. And the one thing about homeless vets is there's a thing called the Homeless Vets Registry, where that we started several years ago as a state based off of the Heading Home plan as an action item, where we're looking at, to your point, that they might a veteran might show up here or there, but there wasn't any coordination going on, particularly around homeless vets. And now we're able to look and see where and coordinate care and identify the homeless vets on person by person and case management system.
Just a short comment. Thank you very much. That I know I asked you a question that was sort of outside of your core purview, so I appreciate your answer.
Of course.
You have 6 minutes.
I understand that. I will keep moving quickly. The other use that's significant that the state authorizes is public housing rehab, and this is where we are able to use general obligation bonds because the housing is publicly owned through housing and redevelopment authorities. So I won't read the slide, but I'll just say that it's a critical asset. It is extremely old assets. It is housing seniors and families and people that are disabled. It is critical. It is falling down. In many cases, this is the high rise in your community, and in that case, it's four stories. But in most cases, it's housing seniors, and that elevator is important to get people from the first floor to the second floor. The fire suppression system is antiquated and not working and faulting. It's plumbing that is falling down and breaking. It's boilers that are not adequately providing heat to the residents. And so this is really asset management, bare bones, keep these assets safe, sanitary for the populations in public housing.
And some pumps that keep running.
Certainly.
Madam Chair, I thought I'd run through a few examples of how we use these the bond proceeds throughout the state. So this just shows you a breakdown of the last 2 years where we awarded projects. The blue dots represent general obligation bonds, so that's public housing or publicly owned housing preservation. And then the triangles are housing infrastructure bonds, so that includes both multifamily projects and single family awards as well. And here's how the numbers break down.
The triangles, right?
Correct.
We can provide a bigger map next time we come.
It's a big state, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you. Please continue.
So throughout the last 2 years, we awarded 21 multifamily projects that, with just the housing infrastructure bonds, impacted a little over 900 homes. Just under $70 million in housing infrastructure bond awards. As far as the single family side goes, a little over 100 homes, and then just under $2 million in awards. So in 2017, we did a preservation project called the Highlands in Rochester. This is 100 rental homes, a total development of over $16.5 million. There were five units set aside for households experiencing homelessness, as well as five households with a disability.
And then this is a new construction, Minnehaha Commons in Minneapolis. This is 43 rental homes, just under $11 million. These are efficiency units. And then about a quarter of them are set aside for households that have experienced homelessness. This is the second phase of Conifer in Bemidji. This is 32 rental townhomes, and this is one of the projects that we were funded this past round. As Mr. Baumtrog mentioned, we had funding made available through last year's bonding bill specifically for households with behavioral health needs, so mental health or chemical dependency. And so these are units that are geared toward those households. And then this is Cahill Place in Inver Grove Heights. This is 40 rental homes, a little over $12 million. So about half of the units in this development are set aside for households that have experienced homelessness or households with a disability. And this is our selections for public housing, kind of a breakdown of those. So we've made $10 million available, or $10 million was made available in 2017 and 2018. We're going to announce this year's awards in March. But we awarded 27 properties in 2017, so a little over 1,800 units impacted. And as you can see, the overwhelming majority of these awards are in greater Minnesota. So a couple of examples of how these funds are used. This is Park Terrace in Hibbing. This is 20 units, a little over a $500,000 award. And this is for boiler and electrical replacement, and then also replacing the piping and plumbing into and around the structure. Then this is the Cedar High Apartments. This is two towers, each 116 units, a little over $2 million. And this is things like elevator modernization. They were converting some units to accessible. Fire alarm and suppression replacement and installation, HVAC, and then kitchen and bathroom improvements. So again, not flashy stuff, but very important in preserving these deeply affordable units around the state. Then this is just a five-year look back. Wanted to provide some additional context, particularly since kind of the inception of housing infrastructure bonds and what we've been able to do with those.
One thing to mention, Madam Chair, and it relates to a question that's asked, is hopefully with the project examples, you get the range of housing needs that are across the state, and that housing infrastructure bonds are not a one-size-fits-all solution for communities. It can mean homeless families in greater Minnesota and Bemidji. It can be homeless vets in St. Cloud. It can be preservation in Rochester. It can be supportive housing for youth in Duluth. And so it is open for communities to work with their homeless teams in the region to understand what their needs are, work with developers in the regions about what the needs are, and then they're able to apply for the resource at Minnesota Housing.
Thank you so much. And we are believers. And we appreciate your presentation. And thank you for being here.
You bet.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks.
Representative Lee.
Madam Chair, I move approval of the minutes from February 12th.
All right. Minutes have been approved, or motion has been made to approve the minutes as printed. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are adopted. You may now partake of Representative Erdahl's Valentine. This meeting is adjourned.